They say the timing is everything, and for Donald Trump, that might as well be his campaign slogan right now. He's been in day-to-day combat in court to keep pushing his criminal cases until after the 2024 election, and there are significant developments tonight concerning the timing of three of those cases in New York, South Florida, and Georgia. In New York, the one criminal trial that was supposed to happen, that everyone thought was going to start 11 days from right now, now appears that it will be delayed by at least a month after an unexpected announcement from the Manhattan District Attorney himself. We'll dig into what that's all about as Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen and company are now waiting to see what the judge is going to decide about the hush money case. It wasn't all good news, I should note, for the former president today. He was denied one attempt to get his charges dismissed in the classified documents case in Florida as he sat there in court before Judge Eileen Cannon. But there's no trial date still from that judge. And of course, that can't make the special counsel happy or the witnesses who are worried for their own safety as all of this is being dragged out. I actually spoke with one of those central witnesses in this case, a former Mar-a-Lago employee who told me that he's prepared to testify.
The boxes that were in the indictment, the white banker's boxes, that's what I remember loading.
And did you have any time, any idea at the time that there was potentially U.S. national security secrets in those boxes?
No clue. No, I had no clue. I mean, we were just taking them out of the Escalade, piling them up. I remember they were all stacked on top of each other, and then we're lifting them up to the pilots.
There's also more. We've talked about New York. We've talked about Florida. Now we are also awaiting a decision that is expected tomorrow in the state of Georgia from the judge who is overseeing Trump's election case there over whether or not to disqualify the Fulton County District Attorney, Fonnie Willis. Judge Scott McAfee said to a reporter today, quote, "I made a promise to everybody. These kinds of orders take time to write. I need to make sure I say exactly what I want to, and I plan to stick to the timeline I gave everyone." Here to help us break all of this down tonight is our most trusted CNN senior legal analyst, Ellie Honig, who was an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, the very office that is now caught up in this case. And also, of course, his book, Untouchable, where he uncovered conversations that got to the heart of this case. So, Ellie, obviously, you're the perfect person to talk about this with. I think the question is, why is this all happening 11 days before this was set to begin?
Yeah, so this is about so much more than a likely 30-day or more postponement. This goes to the heart of the DA's case, and it tells me that there's a real problem lurking here for the DA's case. So let's break this down. 3 years ago, Donald Trump's getting ready to leave office in 2021. My former office, the Southern District of New York, has a series of internal conversations. What do? Do we charge Donald Trump for the hush money scheme? Ultimately, they come out, of course, no. And a big part of the reason why is they did not trust Michael Cohen. They were not willing to base a case on the testimony of Michael Cohen. Okay, now, you're Donald Trump's lawyers now, and you know
this. Thank God I'm not, but yes.
Right.
Go ahead,
well, what would you do? Reasons. You want to get those files, right? Well, geez, the SDNY thought there was a problem with Michael Cohen. We need to know that. And so Trump's lawyers have spent the last year and change trying to extract those documents from the Southern District, and they just started getting them a couple of months ago, 70,000 pages, then another 30,000 pages, and they said to the judge, now we need more time because we have serious stuff in here that we need to use to undermine Michael Cohen. And the DA, to an extent, agrees with that. That's why the DA today said, we agree that some postponement is necessary, at least 30 days. The DA could have said, it's all useless, it's all irrelevant. They did not say that. They said, there is important stuff in there, and this goes to the heart of the case.
So one, that means you think that it is relevant material.
Absolutely, because if it wasn't, the DA would say, no adjournment, let's go in 14 days. The fact that the DA is saying, yes, they're entitled to some time tells me there's something significant in there.
Well, and two, this is the first time we've seen Trump try to delay. We talk about it almost every single day. This is the first time we've seen a prosecutor actually agree in part.
Yeah, and let me lay the blame here. On my own former office, the Southern District of New York, I will plead guilty on their behalf. They're the problem here because they've had these documents. They're the only ones who know what's in these documents, and they have resisted and dragged their feet. Even Alvin Bragg, the DA, has been asking the Southern District, hey, guys, this material could be relevant to the defense. I have an obligation as the DA to turn it over. And only just recently did the SDNY do that.
Okay, but so they, Alvin Bragg, the district attorney here, said 30 days, sure. But what Trump's team is asking for is not even just 90 days. I looked closely at what they said. They said that they should set a new trial or not set a new trial date until they've been able to complete the productions of this material. It said it cannot be any less than 90 days. Yeah. How long do you think this could ultimately be of a delay?
So, of course, Trump's team wants to push it out forever. Here's the thing, though, to keep in mind. So the DA is okay with 30 days. The judge has to give 30 days, essentially, at this point. If the prosecutor's saying they get 30 days, you have to give them that. But
so that's a minimum.
And there's a traffic jam here because Judge Mershon, same judge who has the Trump case, also has the Steve Bannon trial, the Steve Bannon fraud trial set for May. So that is blocking May into June. Now, the judge could sort of play a game of dominoes here and move the Bannon trial to make room for the Trump trial.
What's the likelihood of that?
I suspect this is going to be more than 30 days. I really do. I think.
So you don't think that the judge here will move Steve Bannon's case to make room for Trump's?
That's a decision for the judge. But Steve Bannon's case is older. Steve Bannon's case has been occupying that spot. I think there's a real problem here. I think there's a real question now about whether this case gets tried before the election at all. And it seemed 5 hours ago like this one was virtually certain.
You think it may not get tried before the election?
I do. Because if you have the Steve Bannon case there blocking off May, June, maybe into July, it's a complicated case. When are you going to start this case? Into September, October? That's, I think, too close to the election. I think there's now, for the first time, a real question about whether this case gets tried before the November election.
But that means there's a question of if any case gets tried. Tomorrow the Georgia decision is coming,
yep,
where we find out if Fannie Willis stays on the case. If she does, that's really notable because that means it will continue.
Yeah.
But if she doesn't, there is virtually no chance that goes before the election, right?
I think either way, that case is not getting tried before the election. It's going to take way too long. If she gets disqualified, though, there's a question about whether that case ever happens. But you're right, Caitlin. It felt like for a while the Manhattan DA's case was potentially the only one that would get tried before the election. And now I think there's serious doubt about that, too.
Ellie Honig, your former office, you said you'd plead guilty for them.
Sorry, guys.
We'll see what that looks like. Ellie will stay with you on all of this. Also, I should note that Donald Trump was in a federal courtroom in Florida today for another case, the classified documents case that we've been talking about here all week. But the presence of him in there, in that court, even though he appointed the judge here to the bench, did not seem to slow her down. She quickly denied a motion that he was making, one of many, I should note, to dismiss that entire case. And I'm joined now by an attorney who used to represent Donald Trump in that very case, Jim Trusty. And Jim, it's great to have you back. You know, this was 2 of 9 total motions from the Trump team to dismiss this case. Do you ultimately believe that any of them will be successful?
I think it's possible. I mean, look, today's motion, you got to keep in mind, this was a very academic-oriented motion about void for vagueness, challenging the very statutes that are in play in the indictment. That's always tough sledding. And what the judge did is she denied it without prejudice. So this is basically a punt more than it is a law. She's saying, well, let's get to it when we're sifting through weighty issues of jury instructions way downstream. So I don't think that was anything that was particularly grievous for the Trump team. I think the interesting thing is apparently a lot of reporting says that she raised a number of questions about selective prosecution, about whether President Trump is being treated differently than any other president or even vice president. That's a big note here in history. And I think that means that what's normally, again, a fairly tough motion to establish that DOJ is selectively enforcing a law has some traction with this judge. It wasn't on the table for today, but that's a huge issue the DOJ has to be worried about. And I think it's interesting They're having Jay Bratt do all the argument. The guy that authored all of this mess is kind of left on his own to either have a nice day of winning or absorb all the blame for the misconduct by DOJ.
Just to keep this big picture for people who don't know who Jay Bratt is, obviously he's a prosecutor Working for the Justice Department. What she denied today had to do with the Espionage Act. She said essentially the Trump team's argument would have been extraordinary for her to rule and agree with them on this. But the other one that they were arguing today, the other motion to dismiss, had to do with the Presidential Records Act. And you and I have actually talked about this before. And essentially, you know, the ability that Trump has to decide what records are personal, what belongs to the government. Here's what you've said before about that.
If he wants to personalize them under the Presidential Records Act, that is his right. And that doesn't lead to criminal investigations. It never has before, and it probably never will again.
She said today that that decision, Judge Cannon, would effectively gut the PRA if she agreed with Trump's team on this and allow future presidents to say the documents that are obviously presidential ones are personal. I mean, she's not buying the argument that you are making there. Did it change your mind on that?
Well, I don't think you heard much of my argument in that snippet. But look, not really. I mean, I think that the Presidential Records Act, the issue of whether any of this should be considered criminal or subject to criminal penalties, which the PRA does not have, is still in play when you talk about selective prosecution. Selective prosecution's latching on to the 14th Amendment, talking about due process and equal protection. But the concept of whether every other president and vice president has been essentially immunized by the PRA is still in play, no matter how you frame it specifically on the category. So I think it's still a live wire issue. I think it's something she's going to get to. And the fact that she had these questions is, again, I think a little bit ominous, not absolute, but a little bit ominous for DOJ.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of tea leaf reading. But the other part of this is it's not just about the records. It's also about the obstruction charges in this trial. And I want you to listen to what someone who was only previously known as Trump Employee 5, now known as Brian Butler, told me in our exclusive interview on Monday.
On that day, as you're helping load these boxes unwittingly into the plane and handing them to the pilots, Trump is back at Mar-a-Lago. And did you know that his attorneys were there that day?
It's funny because I remember seeing this taller guy, I think flicked back silver hair. I think it was Evan, who I now know to be Evan Corcoran. And I saw a bunch of other people in the living room. I had no clue. I'm just seeing all these people.
And it was Evan Corcoran, Trump's attorney, and members of the FBI, Jay Bratt.
Which, you know, I come to realize now, at the same time he's going in there, the boxes are going from somewhere into a vehicle, which are eventually going to the plane, which I load with Walt.
Okay, so Jim, if Trump thought he was allowed to keep these documents, as his attorneys argued today and as you have argued before, why was he having them moved out while the FBI is there at Mar-a-Lago to collect said documents?
Well, my first thought is, if he was actually trying to obstruct by hiding documents, why would he leave dozens behind for them to recover through Evan Corcoran? So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Let me just say this.
Well,
I was a prosecutor.
Nope.
Well, Caitlin, let me just finish one thought about your witness. I was a prosecutor for 27 years. I guarantee you, if you're a prosecutor and this guy comes out smiling on TV to talk about his testimony, you are cringing. He has not been cross-examined yet. He may not have been interviewed by anybody but the FBI at this point. So you got to take a wait and see. Maybe he'll be a blockbuster witness. But I tell you what, most blockbuster witnesses don't do TV tours on the same day that Rob Herr's report lands.
Well, he did.
He
did one interview, and I'll note that was not when Robert Herr's report came out weeks ago. It was before he testified on the Hill. But I'll say he did this interview because he's worried that this case is never going to go to trial. And he's also worried about the effort to get his name out there. But let me ask you about what you just said there, because you said, you know, why would he turn over some of the documents? Trump is accused of having his co-defendants go in the storage room and move those boxes before Evan Corcoran even went in there. So why is Trump moving those documents if he thought he had the right to them, even from his own attorney?
Yeah, well, look, let's take a little bit of a wait and see. If the case really goes to trial, I will be the first one to tell you if the obstruction hangs together and it looks like a viable case, I'll hear the evidence and I'll tell you that looked like a pretty viable case. I have a lot of suspicions. The obstruction was added into the mix as a political fig leaf to distance President Trump's situation from that what happened in Delaware. And that's always been kind of the political fig leaf.
But you agree that they're different,
Delaware's
right?
Different. I agree what? I'm sorry.
You agree that they're different.
Oh, absolutely. In a lot of ways that are actually hurtful for President Biden's for President Biden's position. But, you know, look, Rob Herr did a report. He laid out his information. I have some qualms with it. But at the end of the day, it's not that I'm saying that President Biden should have been prosecuted. What we've said from the beginning is systemic changes need to be made to protect the information that is entrusted to our leaders. And that's a problem that goes back at least to Reagan, if not certainly before that, with all sorts of presidents holding on to classified documents and DOJ saying it's their call when it came to Clinton in the Judicial Watch case. So, you know, there's a lot of murkiness there in terms of how the law should be changed. I don't think any of it should be criminalized.
Right.
And I think we'll have to wait and see if that guy gets a day where he's actually cross-examined instead of talking to you.
Well, I think I would say it was a pretty thorough interview. But Jim Trusty, thanks for your time tonight. Appreciate you.
All right. Thanks, Caitlin.
And perspective from someone else who is formerly in Trump world, Anthony Scaramucci is here to talk about what Ellie just laid out, that maybe none of this will go to trial before the November 2020 election, even that one case we thought would. Also, the vice president's historic trip to an abortion clinic. Does it mobilize voters in a crucial election year?
Thank you. I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life, lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
It was 11 months ago that Donald Trump became the first former U.S. president who had ever been indicted. And now, nearly a year later, he is the presumptive Republican nominee. He's just clinched the delegates. And it's not clear if voters are going to get to hear the evidence against him in any of those cases before they decide if he should return to the White House. Few people can speak to this better than someone who is his communications director. Anthony Scaramucci is here with me. And Anthony, it's great to have you. I just wonder if you look at the big picture impact of the conversations we just had with Ellie Honig and with Trump's former attorney, if none of this happens before the trial, what that means.
Well, I think you've got to take that as the status quo. I think any of those other things that could happen before the trial, particularly the documents case, where if you really read through that complaint, that's where the most damning evidence is. If none of that happens, it's a Trump versus Biden rematch. And I think people have to get focused on that. And they've got to run the replay of Donald Trump, what he said, what he did over the 4 years, what he's saying now. He wants to go after you, Caitlin. He's made it very clear that anybody that he disagreed with or he has an adversarial relationship with in the press, he wants to potentially threaten their FCC license. He said publicly he wants to persecute, using the Department of Justice, his political adversaries. And the list goes on and on. He's courting with dictators. He wants to be part of the axis of autocracy with people like Vladimir Putin. And just to remind people, Vladimir Putin is tied very closely to Iran now. So just think about what that means for the Middle East, because we know how transactional Donald Trump is. So I think we got to get off the cases. We have to focus on Mr. Trump being the most un-American presidential nominee in U.S. history. And we have to go through the things that he's saying he's going to do as it relates to being the American president.
About,
and I think if we do that, he's going to lose the election.
What about the human aspect of this? Because obviously, there's also questions about not just what he would do in a second term, but who would work in that administration. And Brian Butler, the former Mar-a-Lago employee that we spoke with this week, he talked about the relationship aspect of this and what Trump does to those around him. This is what he told me.
It must feel like you're choosing between, you know, loyalty to these, to your friends and telling the truth.
Absolutely. And there's no person that wants loyalty more than the former president. I mean, he says it all the time.
I mean, what do you make of what someone who worked for him for 20 years has to say about how he treats people and what that would mean if he takes office again?
Well, I mean, what I would have asked, Brian, though you've seen people come and go, myself included, there always seems to be a group of rubes that get sucked into Trump's orbit and think they're either going to be different this time or he's changed or they're going to change him. And then he just rotates through those people and runs them over. And so that's why 39 of his cabinet members and sub-cabinet members refuse to endorse him at this time. But the one last point, Caitlin, I think this is the most telling point. I'm a little contrarian, and I believe that because he's such a name dropper, he will bring people in from the establishment. He'll want big names in the administration. And so you'll have much of the same thing that took place in 2017, 18, and 19. He's not going to go full loyalist because they're just not big enough names for somebody like Donald Trump.
We'll see what that looks like. Anthony Scaramucci, I know you will not be one of them. Thank you so much for joining tonight.
I don't even want one extra day, Caitlin. Okay, not even one extra. I don't want to make it an even dozen.
Anthony Scaramucci, Mr. 11 Days, thank you for that. Also here, Jamal Simmons, former communications director for vice president, longer than 11 days, and CNN political commentator, SE Cup. I mean, obviously, no one wants to be in the political situation that Donald Trump is in with his legal troubles. But the idea that he's getting all of these delays and delays and delays, and it's working right now.
I think he does want to be in this situation. He is running for president to avoid all this stuff. And this stuff is putting him in significant legal and financial jeopardy, which, by the way, I've said this before, makes him a very serious and vulnerable national security target. The idea that he has this much money and lawsuit, you know, liability, I think makes him a huge target for bribery. And, let's face it, he's probably game for it, right? So I think he is using this campaign to sort of, get through all of this. And it looks like he might. I mean, he might get through it all.
I think a lot of Democrats have been thinking that this would make him a really vulnerable candidate in the general election. What if it doesn't? He's not on trial.
Well, I think what will make him a vulnerable candidate is his position on these issues like taking away abortion, which we saw the vice president talking about today. And when she was in Minnesota.
Governor coming up. So
yes, exactly. Right. I should know better. But no, we saw this. We saw this in the policy positions that the former president had. I think, and people start thinking about whether or not they want to return Donald Trump to office. They will be hearing about so many things that we field tested the last time: bleach being injected. Are we going to have another insurrection if he doesn't win? We'll see him in court. And there's a very practical problem here. If he's in court 4 days a week, that means he's not out campaigning during those days.
But what if he's not in court?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's going to be.
Does that change Democrats' trajectory here?
No, I think Democrats are planning on beating him regardless of whether or not he goes to court. But there's a great possibility that he could be in court for some part of the summer or going into the fall. And if that's the case, that means that he's not going to be out on the road.
I think there was a lot of denialism on the left, and I include myself in the Never Trump camp in that denialism, hoping some deus ex machina event, like a lawsuit, was going to imperil his road to the presidency. And the stages of grief, right, we are not in acceptance yet. And I think a lot of people still want one of these things to be a roadblock. I think we have to get to acceptance, past anger, grief, bargaining, and accept he is going to be the nominee. And it's not going to be a lawsuit that probably keeps him from the presidency. It's going to be the ballot box.
I mean, how do people in Biden world see this? Did the DOJ wait too long on some of this stuff?
No, there's a fight. Well, there's a contest going on. Let's not use the word fight. There's a contest going on between those who believe that there was no alternative, the DOJ did everything right, and there are those who believe in the White House, like, gosh, we really wish that the DOJ would have moved faster on this and that Merrick Garland would have done something about this earlier, and maybe we shouldn't have had some of the special counsel that we had. We really should have done something more. I think that contest of ideas that's happening inside the Democratic Party probably doesn't matter because the political people are all focused on the future of Donald Trump and scaring people about what that future is going to look like.
Jamal Simmons, SC Cup, always great to have both of you here on set. Thank you. And with Trump off the campaign trail today, Team Biden was in full campaign mode today as he was in that Florida courtroom. It included a historic visit by the sitting vice president to an abortion clinic. The first time you have ever seen anything like this. The governor of Minnesota was there with her, and he'll join me right after a quick break. Vice President Kamala Harris made history today when she became the first sitting vice president to tour an abortion clinic.
How dare these elected leaders believe they are in a better position to tell women what they need, to tell women what is in their best interest. We have to be a nation that trusts women.
Here tonight is Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz, who was there with Vice President Harris at Planned Parenthood today and also has signed legislation enshrining abortion rights into state law last year. Also the chair of the Democratic Governors Association. Governor, great to have you here tonight. On this issue and something that we have never seen before, what happened today, does that mean that you expect abortion and reproductive rights is going to be Democrats' greatest strength going into this election?
Well, thanks for having me, Caitlin. Absolutely. It was such a privilege, and it was powerful to be in that room with the vice president as she's speaking truth, and to see her in that space to talk to providers, to hear the stories of women traveling from all over the country. I'm in a part of the country where my neighboring states have tried to criminalize women getting health care, and we're going to make sure that people hear about it because it is a health care crisis. And the idea that they would try and nationalize this, take that away from states like Minnesota that do trust women to make their own healthcare decisions, that do understand that abortion is healthcare. And to see the vice president stand in that space, to be clear that she's not wavering, I don't know if you could see a greater contrast for what this nation is facing. There are numerous issues, but this one is real. It is not hypothetical. It's real. Women are dying. Women are being persecuted. We're seeing women being threatened with jail time for simply pursuing what just 2 short years ago was a protected right. So, yes, we will make sure we know every single day where they stand.
Also, Governor, though, even for Democrats, for your party, just a few years ago, the idea of using this in a campaign year as a campaign issue, having the vice president go to an abortion clinic, is not something that many people or many political advisors would have advocated for. I mean, it must have just surprised you just to really understand the moment we're in with that visual today.
Well, I think so. I think it was probably a mistake we weren't. I ran for Congress in 2006 in a Republican-leaning district, and I spoke very clearly about this. After I won, I remember someone walked up to me and said, "Wow, you won in spite of being for, you know, abortion rights and gay marriage." I said, "You get it wrong. I won because of those things." And I think Democrats have found their voice on this. I think women have understood that we have tolerated this idea that this was just something not to be talked about. It's good to see leaders, you know, coming out. And these are hard decisions, but they're decisions that women make and that their providers make. And I think that's the biggest thing. So you're right. I don't think there was enough about it, but I think you've seen it spring onto this. And let's be very candid. Over the last 20 years, there's more women like Vice President Harris in elected office who can talk about it.
Well, and, you know, when that's definitely right. And we see President Biden, you know, he is someone who he doesn't often use the word abortion himself. I don't think that's totally surprising. He's an 81-year-old Catholic, and his views on this issue have evolved. Do you think that he should lean more into that, though, over the next 8 months, use that word as often as possible on the campaign trail?
Well, you're right. And I think each person, as they start to try and understand this, and you can hold two things are not mutually exclusive, that people of deep faith can also understand that a woman's right to make these choices is important. I do think it was important to listen to Vice President Harris today say, "Look, I'm going to say some words people don't want to hear, like uterus." And she was saying that. I think old white men need to learn how to talk about this a little more. And I think the biggest thing is listen to women, listen to what they're saying. We've seen that when we listen to them, they're speaking loudly on the issue and they're speaking at the ballot box. We've seen time and time again, whether it was the midterms, whether it was in Kentucky with Andy Beshear winning a race down there, being, you know, very firmly supporting women. I think we need to find our voice on it. But I hear the president talking about it. He's out there. His vice president is making history by being the first sitting vice president or president to stand in a space that's a healthcare clinic. Abortion is healthcare. There's other things being done there, mammograms, all kinds of screenings. It's just really, it's a moment that we should seize. And look, the contrast couldn't be greater. Donald Trump has made it very clear. He brags about a lot of things that are not true. He did not create jobs. He's not a scratch golfer. He's not in super good shape, but he did rip Roe out. He did appoint judges who are taking that away, and he will do it again. So I think it's good to hear the language. I think the president's out there making it clear. And the contrast is he said he will sign into law, codifying Roe into law. Donald Trump said he would make the ban nationwide. You couldn't be clearer.
Governor Tim Walz, as always, great to have you on.
Thanks, Kaylin.
Some really notable remarks that happened on Capitol Hill today from the Senate Majority Leader. He is the highest-ranking Jewish elected official in the U.S. He's calling for elections and new leadership in Israel, saying that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is, quote, an obstacle to peace.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Tonight, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party is responding to what they heard from Senator Chuck Schumer, saying that their country is not a banana republic. That's after the Senate Majority Leader went to the floor today to criticize Netanyahu's handling of the war and also called for new elections in Israel.
I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel. At a time when so many Israelis have lost their confidence in the vision and direction of their government.
That rebuke, of course, coming from the highest ranking elected Jewish political leader in American history. And it's a pivotal moment for Netanyahu's support here in the U.S. potentially. And joining me now is the Republican whip, Tom Emmer, the number three Republican leader in the House. And Congressman, it's great to have you joining us tonight. Do you believe that Senator Schumer's remarks were appropriate?
No, absolutely not. I thought they were disgusting, Caitlin. I think they've been talking about how they stand with our best ally in the Middle East, the free democracy of the state of Israel. And today he did just the opposite. And he finally, I think, showed people that no matter what they say, their actions are something completely different.
Well, to be fair to Senator Schumer, I mean, on this front, when he was making these remarks, he said Netanyahu is one of four obstacles he believes that is standing in the way of peace, as he put it. He also cited right-wing Israeli officials and Hamas and the Palestinian Authority and its president, Mahmoud Abbas. Do you agree with him on any of those points?
No, I mean, maybe the last one is part of it, but no, absolutely not. Chuck Schumer does not have a problem with Benjamin Netanyahu. He does not have a problem with the people of Israel. What he's got a problem with are the anti-Semites that have taken over his Democrat Party. You cannot equivocate on this at this time, Caitlin. You got to choose between right and wrong, between good and evil. And quite frankly, for Chuck Schumer to be calling for a new election in Israel is it's abhorrent. And by the way, if he really was interested in calling for an election, how about in Gaza, where they haven't had one since 2006 when Hamas took over? What he said today was outrageous and disgusting.
Well, you said you agree with him on the last point about the Palestinian Authority leader, Abbas, but I imagine you also agree with him on Hamas also being an obstacle here. I mean, I just wanted to make sure that that's clear.
If you want to call for peace, then Hamas has to be eliminated. They cannot exist any longer. It's clear after October 7th that that is not an option. So you want peace? Then Hamas needs to lay down its arms and be done.
The important context of Senator Schumer's remarks is that he is the highest ranking Jewish elected official in our nation. And as he was talking about Netanyahu and calling for a new election, he was talking about the devastating death toll that we are witnessing happening in Gaza. Do you personally believe that Israel and Netanyahu's government is doing what it can to avoid civilian casualties?
I do. We had Ambassador Herzog was with us at our retreat today, went through what they are trying to do, which is you've got Hamas that is literally using hostages and the Palestinian people to try and protect themselves. They're holding them for a reason. By the way, they just killed another American hostage last week, Caitlin. This is about Hamas. This is not about the state of Israel, unless you're talking about the state of Israel's survival.
That was the announcement that Itai Hen was killed. But on the comment you just made a few moments ago, you said that Schumer's real issue, you believe, is dealing with the people in his party. You said they're anti-Semites. Obviously, the progressives and the Democratic Party would disagree with that. They would say that they have an issue with how Israel is conducting this war. But I think the bottom line question here is what's going to happen with funding to Israel? And you're standing at the Republican retreat right now. And the bill that came over from the Senate that does have money for Israel has not been brought up for a vote on the House floor. That's because of also the Ukraine aid and what else is in this bill. What is going to happen? How is the House going to handle this? Are Republicans in the House going to split up an Israel aid bill into one and a Ukraine aid bill into another vote?
So first, your statement about what the progressives would say is that these aren't anti-Semites, when in fact they refuse to condemn Hamas. They try to justify this brutal attack. Prehistoric attacks on women and children and the elderly. If you're not willing to condemn Hamas, then clearly you are not. It's about the Jewish people to you. And I'll stop there. But the other piece is they've had the Israel supplemental bill from the House since October, Caitlin. Let's not get into this, you know, the he said, she said. We sent that supplemental bill off the House floor over to the Senate back in October, and Chuck Schumer has refused to act. He complained about a pay for because we were taking money away from the IRS to pay for the $14.2 or $14.3 billion that had been requested. So guess what? We tried to do one without a pay for. And not only would the 166 Democrats in the House voted against it, they chose to side with Hamas instead of the state of Israel. But you had a president, Joe Biden, who threatened to veto it if it passed. You
Republicans in the Senate
that
also had an issue with that
bill. But your actions speak louder than your words.
Republicans also had an issue with that bill.
Again,
but I think the
Schumer.
Question is, if you're in Israel or if you're in Ukraine right now, what the House is going to do and what House Republicans are going to do. And so that's my question. What is your plan?
Again, Caitlin, the question really isn't what House Republicans are going to do. House Republicans have already done it. The question is, will Chuck Schumer actually move the bill that's in front of him? If he doesn't like the pay for, he can take it off. And by the way, yeah, maybe Republicans were, but they're not in charge of the Senate. Chuck Schumer is in charge of the Senate. The issue is with Chuck Schumer and his Democrat majority in the Senate and with the president and his administration. They are not standing with Israel. They are siding with Hamas.
But are House Republicans going to bring a standalone Israel aid bill and a standalone Ukraine aid bill to the floor? Is that your plan right now?
Two different issues. We already brought a standalone Israel bill to the floor 2 or 3 weeks ago.
But it doesn't have any chance of passing in the Senate. So realistically,
Democrats,
what is the House going to
chose
do
to vote
issue?
Against it? Well, why wouldn't it have a realistic chance of passing the Senate if you truly do support our best ally in the Middle East, the state of Israel? Why would it not have a chance, Caitlin? Unless, of course, Chuck Schumer, is his problem is with the anti-Semites in his party, and that's the president's problem as well, and they're playing politics with an issue that is not about politics. It's about the very survival of the state of Israel.
Okay, I just want to give you one last chance to tell me what the House is going to do, because they have been the ones that, the House Republicans are the ones who are standing in the way of the bipartisan bill that passed the Senate with aid for Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan. So what is the House's plan?
Again, the House has already acted. We've not only acted once, we've acted twice. There's a bill sitting over in the Senate right now that they can pass. If we have to continue to lead, which we will continue to lead. But right now, they already have the money that they need. They just need to process the bill, Caitlin.
I think it's still a big question of what House Republicans are going to do. We'll see what happens when you're back in Washington. Congressman Tom Emmer, thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you, Caitlin.
A new book shedding light on what a potential second Trump term could look like, with some ominous warnings from former top officials who worked there, who served there. We'll talk about that right after a quick break. With Donald Trump now locked as the presumptive Republican nominee for president, his brand of America First is one election victory away from becoming American foreign policy again. And amid this, there are dire warnings coming from those who worked the closest with him on that very issue. In his new book, CNN's Jim Sciutto cites a senior U.S. official who served in both the Trump and Biden administrations at a high level that says in a second Trump term, the U.S. will be out of NATO. Of course, NATO is probably the most important security alliance that the U.S. is part of. And CNN anchor and chief national security analyst Jim Sciutto joins us now with more reporting on his new book, The Return of the Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. Jim, and this book is full of fascinating insights from these people who worked with Trump. And at one point, John Bolton is quoted there with this story about what he means, basically his concerns about what's going to happen to Taiwan if Trump is back in office.
Add Taiwan to the list of countries' alliances that his former advisors say the U.S. will abandon effectively under a second Trump administration. And what he would do, he would be in the Oval Office, he would hold up the tip of a Sharpie pen at his desk and say, and point to the tip of the pen and say, this is Taiwan, and then point to the resolute desk and say, this is China. The point being, Taiwan is so small, too small to successfully defend itself against a Chinese invasion, and crucially, therefore, too small for the U.S. to care about or defend itself. And I had multiple officials, including Bolton as well, and John Kelly and others say, if I were Taiwan, I'd be very worried in the second term.
And we've seen the warnings about how that could be a reality in the next several years. It's not a foregone conclusion.
No question.
The other part, though, is John Kelly is similarly as concerned as Bolton. They have different warnings. But one thing that he was talking about is South Korea and the U.S. reducing its commitment there. And I was struck by this quote where he told you that Trump was just dead set against having troops in South Korea again as a deterrent force or having troops in Japan. And if you've been in the U.S. military and this has been the status quo for so long, changing that would be fundamentally different for the United
States.
No question.
The thing is, it's a consistent thing with Trump. He does not see the value of these decades-old U.S. alliances, whether it be NATO, as you were describing earlier, South Korea, or Japan, and alliances that have helped keep the peace and defend key American allies. He just sees them as too costly. And the other piece of that we should note is that the adversaries on the other side of those alliances, whether it's Russia on the other side of NATO, North Korea on the other side of South Korea, or China, other side of Japan, they would love if the U.S. were to reduce or end those commitments because it would be very much to their advantage.
Obviously, John Kelly and John Bolton aren't going back in another Trump administration. But Anthony Scaramucci said something earlier. He said that Trump would be pulled to have the big names in a second term, that it wouldn't just be, you know, the people who the concerns of the loyalists and who would be first picked to serve. What is your sense from the people you spoke with for this book?
These people will never work for him again. John Kelly, John Bolton, others, they say quite openly he's a danger to the country. I mean, they've said this publicly. I mean, John Kelly had a long conversation with him about how Trump expressed praise for Hitler while in office, and he was just flabbergasted that this was even possible. So those folks won't go within a mile of the White House. Do I believe that Trump will attempt to get big names? To Scaramucci's point, I absolutely believe it. But it's a question as to who would take that job at this point, particularly folks who have direct experience of working with him, with his decision-making, and decision-making like we've just described here.
Because if you're a big name and you go in and you're running the Pentagon under a Donald Trump presidency, I mean, what does that look like if he pulls out of NATO, which is what these officials tell you is a really big concern.
No question. And by the way, you know, Congress has passed legislation, as you know, that requires congressional approval to leave NATO. But the point that
because Congress is so good to standing up to Trump.
Exactly. The point is that he could neuter NATO without signing a piece of paper to remove the U.S. from it. Because as commander in chief, if he would refuse to send U.S. forces to defend, say, an Eastern European NATO ally, then that treaty means nothing. Article 5 of the treaty means nothing. So this is the thing. He will have tremendous power. There are a lot of reasons why this election is a major choice for American voters, as you know, a whole host of domestic policy questions. But on international policy, Trump would represent a 180-degree turn, not just from Biden, but from successive Republican and Democratic presidents going back decades. And for our allies, a dramatic turn as well.
It's such a good point that he wouldn't even have to formally pull out of NATO. He could just do it by way of
if he says, like he said the other day, Russia, do whatever the hell you want in an Eastern European country, he's the man who would have to order those troops in.
Jim Sciutto, the book is fascinating.
Thank you so much for coming up here to talk
to us about it.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.